No business that is profitable is going to be perfectly stable over time. So there's a gap between understanding volatility and then dealing with it in real time. One of the most important financial skills is being able to recognize when things are abnormally good. When you are surprised by something that happens in the world, the correct takeaway is that the world is surprising. Being anchored to the old reality becomes the liability.
Welcome back to the Reside Platform podcast. We have a really exciting episode for you. This is author Morgan Housel. He's a best-selling author of Psychology of Money. Over 5 million copies sold and likely to continue to sell millions of copies over the next couple decades because it is a timeless treasure, one of the best money books ever written. It's the number one book that I give all my friends, all my clients, all my the people that I care about in business. It's been translated in over 50 languages. He's also the author of the new book, Same As Ever, that is already a bestseller that you must get. This is a great conversation. Morgan and I talk about margin of safety, the difference between being rich and being wealthy, how it's many people know how to get rich, but they can't stay that way. We talk about the NAR settlement. We talk about the future of the real estate industry and how it relates to what happened to stockbrokers turned financial advisors. It's a wide-ranging conversation. There are many, many breakthroughs that you're going to want to pay attention to because I truly believe the conversation we had is going to help you navigate the future real estate industry and find ways to adapt and change and be the survivor that is going to benefit more than ever before. It is likely that the people that do adjust and change and survive this industry right now are going to do better than they've ever done before. Full stop. And it starts with this conversation. So enjoy this conversation with Morgan Housel. Hey, Morgan, how's it going?
Good to see you, Nick. So happy to be here. Happy to have a conversation with you. I'm looking forward to it.
We're really excited to have you on the podcast. We've been talking about doing this for probably a year when we launched the Reside platform because you and I used to talk quite a bit over the years, and you were instrumental in helping me write my book, at least guide me in writing my book as an author. And you just shared with me Psychology Money, 5 million copies sold. And the recent book, Same As Ever, I love that book. It was gifted to me, strangely enough. I was going to buy it, and then it was gifted to me. So I already know that you have these followers throughout the United States and over the world. What is it like to have a fan base?
I think it's, of course, it's great. It's awesome. If you're a writer, that's what you want. I think there is also a thing, if I were to just give the full picture, because, of course, the honest answer is, it's awesome. The full picture, though, is I think if you have a large group of followers like that, there can be a sort of liability that comes attached with it, particularly in the sense of you get a lot of people who are like, what's next? What's next? What's next? And that's a liability. That's like on your personal balance sheet, that's a liability. You have these people who are like, hey, like here we are now, entertain us, kind of thing. And so that's always the thing. It's also it sets expectations higher. If your first book does well, everyone wants your second book to be even better, and that it creates a level of expectations that is super hard to meet. And I think that's probably true in any business. It's true for in the real estate business. It's true for financial advisors. Of like, if you do something well once, people are like, "Great, your next one better be better, or else you're going to disappoint me."
Okay. A lot of real estate teams and broker owners, 2020, we thought we were going to lose everything. Yeah. So did everyone else. But then the opposite happened, and we broke every single record we ever had. Every personal record, our agents were breaking all the records. We were breaking, sales records, volume records, income records, 2021, 2022. Interest rates go from 2 to 7%, 3 to 7%, and we have these team leaders, broker owners that they're no longer setting new marks, right? So you talked about the one book, Psychology Money, 5 million copies sold. Your next book on its own merits, crushing it, but is not living up to the same trajectory. So how do you, if you were talking to a broker owner or top salesperson, how do they deal with that regression to the mean, or, you know, go not setting new personal records?
I think about it in a couple different ways. One is, you know, for the second book, you know, it's still young. It's only been out for 4 months. So there's still plenty of time for it to do very, very well, which is important because no business that is profitable is going to be perfectly stable over time. What you're getting paid for is a level of volatility. That is true. No matter what your business is, that's usually what you're being paid to put up with and endure, is the fact that you might get paid this month, you might get paid 6 months from now, you might have a big year 5 years from now. And if you want stability, if you want that, you know, level of just very predictable, that exists in the world. You can go get a salary and you're going to likely earn way less than you otherwise could as a business owner. So I think just realizing that volatility is what you're paying, is what you're signing up for. And that is the cost of admission to doing well over time, is a truth that applies to any business, any investing strategy. That's important to keep in mind.
So you're signing up for volatility. So are you surprised that you're making less money than you did previously, right? Are you surprised that it's going to be hard occasionally? Are you surprised in this? You shouldn't. What you're kind of saying to me is like, you shouldn't be that all that surprised. You should be fairly prepared for that. Now, yeah, what preparations do you take knowing that you're signing up for volatility?
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. There's this irony of like investors or business people who, even if they're like, yes, I'm signing up for volatility. And then you're like, great, that means you're going to make 40% less this year than you did last year. And they're like, wait, what? Like, I didn't, like, who? That's not supposed to happen. So there's a gap between understanding volatility and then dealing with it in real time. I think, look, so much of my background is in investing in the stock market. I know that's very different here, but I think this applies to virtually anything. The most important data that any stock market investor can get their hands on is the historical prevalence of volatility. So you look at 100 years of data in the stock market, and you see that on average, every year, it declines at least 10% from its previous high. Every 2 or 3 years, it'll decline at least 20%. And once a decade, it'll decline 30 to 50%. That's the historic norm during a period that you made 200-fold on your money during that 100-year period. And so just coming to terms with how common that volatility is super important. Now, I know in real estate, it might be slightly different, but look, I think what the equivalent here would be looking at the long-term history of interest rates. And if you look at interest rates over the last 100 years, two things will stick out. One, the idea of a 3% mortgage is, of course, that is the historical anomaly. Of course, people know that. But the other thing is we went through a decade period over the last 10 years or so, from, or even more than that, it was probably from about 2009 to 2022, where interest rates were not only low, they were more or less flat. There was very little volatility. It was, you know, they hover between 0 and 2%. That is extremely rare historically. It is very common historically for interest rates to go from 2 to 7 to 8, back down to 1, back up to 9. That's the norm. Like, crazy volatility in interest rates has been the norm. So I think coming to terms with that is really important too. So I understand why people will be taken off guard and struggle during periods like this. But I think if you look historically, the last 10 years are the anomaly. This year, the last 2 years are not the anomaly. It was 2009 to 2022 that was the historical outlier.
And it's when you made me think about that period of low interest rate and how the involatility wasn't there. It was stability. It was stable. Yeah. It was constant. It was consistent growth in the real estate sales industry, where we're getting paid to sell homes. We get commissions when things transact. And that becomes the normal, though. Like, what happens is we get lulled into this thinking that this is normal. And the little blips, the little changes are the instability. So interest rates going from, you know, 3.5 to 4, and we're seeing sales decline just slightly. That's the involatility. An agent leaves our office. That's the involatility, right? A new competitor's doing better marketing than us. That's the involatility. But it really isn't, right? Like, there's something bigger, like a black swan. There's a bigger event happening that we should be prepared for.
I mean, the biggest were the 1970s and 80s, where their period would be like, interest rates 1 year are 5%, and the next year they're 12%. And then the year after that, they're back down to 4%. And then the next year, they're 13%. It was crazy. And I think you could say that the Federal Reserve is better, smarter, and has more tools today than they did back then. That's not to say that there won't be bubbles or that they can't screw up. That's not what I'm saying. But I do think that you could make a reasonable argument that some of the recent relative stability is because the Fed just acts differently now than they used to. That's, you know, I have to preface that again with, that doesn't mean that things can't hit the fan, but it's a very different world than it used to be. But I would not be surprised. This is not a forecast per se, but I would just not be surprised if we look back 30 years from now. 30 years from now, you and I are having this conversation, and we're like, oh, that era of low interest rates that existed during this tiny little window from 2009 to 2022, that, like, what a crazy world that was, but it never came back. And that going forward, you know, maybe the floor for interest rates is close to where we are now. Maybe it's between 3 and 5%. And during periods of an economic boom, it goes up to 7%. That would not surprise me in the slightest. Mm. And people can adapt to that. The real estate market can adapt to that. Home prices can adapt to that. We're in this window, it feels like right now, of being in just not recognizing where it is and just like not wanting to come to terms with where we are. And maybe I think it's already starting to adapt. Maybe last year, in the last 18 months, was a period of just outright denial about what it is. But I see it from my layperson's view. I don't know what you're seeing, but it seems like the real estate market is at least starting to slightly adapt to the interest rates it is, rather than just the deep winter freeze that it was for the previous 18 months.
Yeah. You know, and on the threat of instability, you know, our industry inherently is instable in that, in terms of your income, because we're 100% commission based. So there's highs and lows all the time. Even in a great market, you might have a boom month or a boom quarter and then have, you know, a slow sales season in the seasonality. And so with that, what I learned from you is this margin of safety, you know, preparing for that with, so that I can handle those moments and that my decision-making isn't hindered because I'm under all this stress and anxiety and fear.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that, because, you know, how do you talk to that person that's working on running a business or working in a business that's 100% commission?
I think one of the most important financial skills is being able to recognize when things are abnormally good and stocking a little bit away, so to speak. That's extremely important. No matter what business you're in or how you invest, that little skill might be the single most important thing. And so when you're going through a period where it's like, man, I had a great quarter, I had a great month, I had a great year. Okay, increase your savings rate from there. Increase what you're setting aside from there. Almost nothing in finance will matter more over time than your margin of safety, than your ability to withstand volatility. And so much about investing is not your ability to avoid volatility. It's your ability to absorb and endure it. Mm. And the only way that you're going to do that is with a level of safety. Now, during the boom times, if you just have a bunch of cash sitting in a checking account, in a savings account, you are very cognizant of the opportunity cost of that. Oh, I could be investing this in my business or in real estate or in stocks and earning a way higher return. That is the wrong way to think about it, full stop. The right way to think about it is that cash that is sitting there in the checking account is the oxygen that you're going to need when these good times end. And when those good times end, it truly is oxygen. You can't go a day without this. And there are so many people who are very good at getting rich and have no ability to stay rich. And those are two very different skills, getting rich versus staying rich. Getting rich is like seeing an opportunity, being optimistic about yourself, being optimistic about the economy. And that's actually not that rare of a skill. Quite a few people can do that. The rare skill is staying rich. It's being able to maintain your business or your investments during the bear market. That is the rare skill. I'll tell you the most potent example of this I've ever seen. It's Bill Gates, who, when he started Microsoft, took the most optimistic swing that any entrepreneur has ever taken. It was back in the 1970s, and he said every desk in the world needs a computer on it. It seemed like the craziest, wildest thing. At the same time, the way he managed Microsoft's balance sheet was as conservative and pessimistic as any entrepreneur could ever do. From the day he started Microsoft, he said, I want enough cash on the balance sheet so that I can make payroll for 1 year with no revenue. And he did that because he knew his business was going to be so volatile. And he kept that philosophy throughout the entire time that he ran Microsoft, even when it was a $500 billion company, same philosophy, tons of cash, very little debt, because there's no guarantee of tomorrow. And we know we're going to hit these periods where business is going to tank for 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. And that's really rare. I think you could say there are tech entrepreneurs who are just as technologically visionary and gifted at Bill Gates, but they had no skill at staying rich. They ran themselves over a cliff. And so they don't exist anymore. They all went out of business. And that skill in any business is super important. The ability to be a visionary, optimistic risk taker, and at the same time, the ability to be very pessimistic and conservative with how you manage your balance sheet, super important.
You know, in the real estate world, I learned this a long time ago from a business consultant and a mentor, to have 6 months of core capital. Because in a 100% commission business, imagine a world in which you make no sales for 6 months and you have to make that payroll. Like Bill Gates, and having a year of Microsoft payroll is a lot of money. That's a lot of cash to be sitting on. There's probably opportunities coming across Bill Gates' desk all the time that he would love and he could make a huge return on, but he doesn't do it. So that 6 months core capital is really important. Now, it's easy to understand, yeah, that makes sense. I want 6 months of core capital to pay all my expenses. And it's another thing to actually go through and do it, because right now, what do you do when you're at a deficit? What do you do when you're running at a deficit and you need to move the needle on revenue?
So for people who don't have that 6 months of core capital, and they're like, great, thanks for telling me this now, but my business just tanked. I don't have the time to build that up. I do think there is a truth. It's a very hard truth to swallow, but there are a lot of people in many different industries. This is not just real estate or just realtors, but there are a lot of people in that situation for whom it might be too late. And now your ability to survive is going to solely depend on your ability to very quickly adapt. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a lot of core capital, you can wait it out and keep the business model, keep the skills, maybe even keep the employees that you had before. If you don't have that, then it is adapt or die, and adapt or die tomorrow. Now, the upside to this, the optimistic side of this, is there is so much history in the economy of the biggest innovations, the biggest breakthroughs, the most productivity happens during periods when shit has hit the fan. Mm. The most productive economic decade ever was the 1930s, the Great Depression. And the reason it was so productive, the reason we got so many new technologies and businesses became so efficient, is because every business in America in the 1930s woke up and said, if we don't become more productive today, we are not going to survive tomorrow. And so every business was like, how do we get more efficient? How do we get more efficient? Do we need all these employees? How can we streamline our supply chains? And it made virtually everyone who survived, that's the big qualifier, more productive. And so that's the upside to this, of when you are waking up kind of scared. It's like, okay, if you can survive this, you're probably going to look back and be like, I transformed my business for the better during that period. And look, the truth is a lot of people will not survive that, because they have a skill of doing this thing during the boom times, but they don't have the personality or the skills or the brave to turn things around when things are tough right now. So that's really what it is. I mean, I know I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but the real estate ruling and settlement is a lot of things. I mean, very similar things have happened in the financial advice business over the last 50 years. And really what you see during these periods are the people who could adapt did better, and the people who couldn't went out of business. And it's true for a lot of different industries that have been deregulated over time. The airline business used to be very heavily regulated. Stockbrokers used to be more regulated than they are right now. During these periods of deregulations, I'm making these numbers up, but let's say 20% of people end up way better than they were before. 20% of people go out of business, and the others kind of, struggle to make a living during what used to be a very prosperous industry. That's probably directionally true.
Yeah. And I think, talking about the settlement, the NAR settlement, and it hasn't been finalized, but it's becoming more and more clear how that's going to change what's going to be required of the industry, how the industry adapts is still unknown, and how the consumer reacts to that transparency and commission is unknown as well. And I thought about this in a number of ways. Your new book, Same as Ever, is, when everyone's looking at this settlement, they're trying to predict the future reality. or the future in today's reality? How do I adjust to what the future will look like? How do we look at this settlement and the real estate industry and say, what's not going to change? What's likely not going to change here?
Let me tell you a quote that I love from Daniel Kahneman, who is an amazing psychologist. He just passed away 2 days ago. He was 90 years old, but he was an amazing guy. Won the Nobel Prize in economics for his work in behavioral finance. And I went to a dinner, like a big group dinner with him 10 or 15 years ago. And he had this quote that I loved. He said, when you are surprised by something that happens in the world, the correct takeaway is that the world is surprising. And what he meant by that is, like, when you are surprised, don't try to be like, okay, the world changed. What does that mean for the future? When you are surprised, the takeaway is that you cannot predict the future. That's the takeaway. It's a very like subtle point that I thought was really important. And so everyone is looking at the settlement. This is your industry, not mine. So you have much more insight to this, but looking at and be like, okay, now given this new law, how can we extrapolate that and look at the future and try to predict the future? And the truth is, no. If you are completely surprised by that settlement relative to where the world was 5 or 10 years ago, the correct takeaway is you do not know how the industry is going to change over the next 5 or 10 years. There could be a new law, a new real estate boom, a new agency, whatever it might be, that is going to completely transform the industry for better or worse over the next 10 years. So all of this, the correct takeaway from the settlement is the world is surprising. It changes very quickly. Sometimes the changes are for the better, sometimes they're for the worse. And this all gets back to what you mentioned earlier. There's nothing more important than adaptability and margin of safety in business and investing.
Yeah, and I looked at when it comes to these changes, and what you said is so true, that 20% of the people are likely going to be doing better in the future.
Yeah.
And the reality of that is there's going to be an attrition. A lot of people are going to fail out of the industry. That already happens in real estate all the time. It happens in all businesses. If you look at restaurants, most of them fail, but some of them survive. And then you have that mom and pop that's been in business forever. And then you have another restaurant that becomes a franchise and a chain, and it spreads across America, right? That 1% of the 1%. So to me, what I learned from you too is reading Nassim Taleb, Daniel Kahneman, Charlie Munger, is sometimes the goal is just to survive. And to survive isn't just to hunker down and protect. To survive is to take action and adapt and change and work and get in the trenches and really find out the truth of the market versus hypothesizing about the market or trying to guess what the market is doing. Like actually going in there and talking to the buyer, talking to a seller, talking to your agents, getting back into the field. So a lot of times in business, the team leader or broker owner or CEO, they get so far removed from what's actually happening, that distance, they it's hard for them to predict. Do you have any stories or thoughts on that when the person is so far removed from the actual transaction, they can't make clear decisions?
Let me give a perfect analogy to what's going on, I think, in the realtor business. In the stock market, stock advice, stock commissions by stockbrokers used to be fixed. And I forget the exact rate, but just to make this like very clear, let's say it was 6%. And I think that's actually roughly close to what it was. Before, I think it was the late 1970s, if you were a stockbroker, you charged 6% on your commissions and it was fixed. I think most you couldn't
have
more or less than that. It was almost completely analogous to what's going on right now. And then I think it was the late 1970s or the early 1980s. I don't know the exact year, but it was around that era. It became deregulated. And you know who the first person was who looked at this and said, this is my chance to make a fortune, was a guy named Charles Schwab, who started a discount brokerage and became a decabillionaire. And so and if you look at the entire industry as a whole, I think it's probably about right that 20% of financial advisors ended up way better in the new system because they figured out how to add value. They came up with new fee structures. They really had to very clearly prove the value that they're adding to for their customers. One of which was, back in the day, we used to call them stockbrokers because that's all they did. They would broker your stock market trades. And now we call them financial advisors because now they add lots of advice. They help you with your tax planning, your retirement planning, your accounting, your bonds, insurance. It's much more holistic. The sole reason that exists is because of the deregulation. where all these, what used to be stockbrokers said, we need to find new ways to add advice for people because we can't live off this fat fixed rate 6% commission that we used to. And look, if you look at the industry today, it is so much, it adds more value, and financial advisors can make way more money today than existed in the 1970s. Now, that's not to say, I'm sure, I don't know the exact numbers, but what percentage of stockbrokers went out of business after deregulation? Probably a lot. There's probably a lot. And there are probably a lot who stayed in business but didn't make nearly as much money as they used to. That's the tough reality of it. But if you look back at it over a long period of time, there are people like Charles Schwab who realized this new world was like opened up endless new opportunities to add value for people. Same with E-Trade and TD Ameritrade. There are all these new companies that could not exist under the old regulated platform. And not only that, but for consumers, if you have a financial advisor today, you are very likely getting so much more value and paying lower fees than you used to in that world. So it's this combination of like, totally get why it's scary. And a lot of people are not going to survive it. But I think overall, there is a historical precedent. And it's almost exactly the same because it's in financial advice, the same kind of industry, for things ending up in a way better spot than it used to be.
It's almost a perfect analogy, you know, a perfect case study to look back on and kind of see how that changes. Now, there was a time in which we were called, my company in general, we were calling ourselves advisors. You know, so this isn't a new thought that has been in the real estate industry. No one's actually executed on it, where the consumer was seeing us not as just an agent or a broker, but as an advisor. And a financial advisor, I'm sure they're advising on other things like life insurance, whole life plans, other types of investments, not just stocks, right? They're looking at tax efficiencies, and they have strategic partners that can help them further their life. And maybe they don't make commissions on that. Maybe there's an affiliate. Maybe it's not legal to do that, but that relationship with other people is going to increase their referral base, you know? And I'm sure some financial advisors, there's probably, you know, the financial advisors that got into the industry after the deregulation, right? I think about that in the real estate industry. You know, there's us that already have all of this knowledge that may not apply in the future. And then there's the people that are going to join the industry today or in a year from now. What type of advantage do they have, Morgan? The people that enter the industry in the future, do they have a leg up?
Of course. I mean, they have a leg up just because their expectations are not anchored to a world that doesn't exist anymore. Mm. So Charles Schwab, back in the 70s, the entrepreneur, had such a leg up over Morgan Stanley Dean Witter back in the day, where we chose, you know, a big brokerage that was like, we used to charge 6% commissions, and now that went away. What the hell do we do now? And they were so anchored to the old way that they couldn't figure it out. But you had all these upstarts who are like, I'll just come up with a brand new business model. I don't have any of the baggage that everyone else does. And now if you are a young financial advisor entering the industry today, if you told them, hey, did you know commissions on stock sales used to be fixed, regulated at 6%? They would be like, what? What kind of world is that? They can't even fathom that kind of world. So it's always that, you know, being anchored to the old reality becomes the liability. To it. And I think, I'm sure there are a lot of people who can just psychologically, mentally just abandon that reality and be like, it doesn't exist anymore. Don't be in denial about it. We just got to figure out a new business model going forward. Those people will do great. They'll not only do great, they'll probably make more money than they used to. I think it used to be the case that, you know, in stockbrokers, when it was regulated, you had a lot of brokers who could make a pretty good amount of money. And today you have fewer brokers who can make a ton of money. Is probably where it ends to. And you do. And, you know, if you are a financial advisor today with $1 billion or $5 billion under management, you're making a fortune. You're making dynastic wealth. You have a mansion on Palm Beach. Some of them fly private jets. And that's after the deregulation, of course. But there are fewer of them than there used to be. And I think it's a very hard reality. I know that this is like, it's not something that you can just push to the side or grin at when you say something like this. But it's almost certainly the case, from my layperson's point of view, looking at it, that in 10 years, there will be fewer realtors. But the ones that survive and adapt will probably be making more money today than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
And and it's hard for people to imagine that because they're only imagining it with a certain commission rate that they're used to seeing and getting paid a certain way. But in the future, there may be multiple ways of getting paid, multiple service, multiple value propositions versus just one proposition or two propositions, meaning I'll help you sell your home, I'll help you buy a home. There may be multiple facets of streams of income. So even though a rate may go down, it may open doors over here that we don't even know exist right now, like financial advisors, I'm sure. Now, is there a case study or in the financial advisor world where, okay, we go from 6% to 1% or to 1.5% or some type of model, right? Or some really low fee like Vanguard or Charles Schwab, where you can get an index fund for a fraction of the price, but we're going to get a million, 2 million, a billion customers, right?
Yeah.
Is there another one where they go ultra value, ultra care, ultra service, ultra exclusivity, and charge high prices?
I mean, the other industry, high profile industry that was deregulated around the same time, 1970s, 1980s, were airlines. And it used to be that airline ticket fares were federally regulated. And then they became deregulated. And that was a really tough thing for the airline industry, but it also created a whole new crop of low cost airlines, Southwest and Frontier and Spirit, those kind of airlines that could not have existed back in the day. If you look at pictures of air travel from the 1960s, 1970s, it's absurd. It was like even in coach, quote unquote, it looked like not only first class, but the most luxurious first class you could imagine. And even if you were sitting in coach, you had, you know, the finest whiskey in a crystal glass and were being served on fine china in coach. That's what flying used to be like. The reason it was like that is because the airfares were regulated to such a high degree that it was very, very expensive to fly. It was really only rich people who could fly back in the day. And then after deregulation, fares plunged. You had all these new airlines pop up and it pushed it down so that even lower middle class people could start to fly now. And that was great. And look, the airline industry has always been a very fraught industry. It's tough to say. I'm pretty sure the statistic is from Kitty Hawk through today, in aggregate, the industry has lost money. It's never made any money. It's just very hard to run an airline. But look, did deregulation kill airlines? Well, I think some of them, yes, but it also sparked a whole new crop. And like Southwest Airlines is one of the most inspiring, prosperous entrepreneurial stories ever, to take something that was so hard to break into, so capital intensive, and to create an incredible business from there. That happened because of deregulation. And look, I think you could also say, maybe this analogy is a stretch, but like what happened after deregulation is flying went from very ritzy and high end for like very wealthy people, and then it got pushed down. So then the seats got smaller. We crammed in more seats to try to make up for it. What came out of that in a very small degree, and again, this might be a stretched analogy, were private jets. That was a very like know-nothing industry in the 1970s and 80s that exploded over the last 30 or 40 years. I think at least a small part of that is because flying commercial became such a lower-end, less luxurious activity than it used to be. So the small sliver of society who could afford that was like, oh, flying commercial is not for me anymore. We're going to do it private. So maybe that's an example of like after deregulation, you had this ultra high end tier because the massive tier, the tier that was made for the masses, just became more, a little bit more, less luxurious than it used to be.
Yeah. 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 With the deregulation too, in the airline industry, the government used to regulate the routes that you could have. So, you know,
that's right. This too is your field. You're a former pilot.
Yeah. I'm a former. Yeah, I have a degree in business administration, you know, a business degree in aviation specialization. But they regulated the routes, which limited the supply as well. Yes. And so they were making money with fewer seats. The other interesting fact about real estate industry, I mean the airline industry, is the load factor, which is the number of seats versus the number of paid passengers. So we call them rev heads. Or non-revs. Non-revs are people like the pilot getting to their destination that aren't paying. The load factors used to be 40, 50%. So half the plane was empty. And then after deregulation, load factors, when I was studying this in 2001, 2002, 70, 68%. That was the industry strategy, 68% load factor. So you used to never have a middle seat. No one would ever buy a middle seat. It's kind of funny now, though. It's like load factors are like 100. When was the last time you went on a commercial airline and it wasn't packed? Like, hey, you know, so it has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it kind of does, because as they became more efficient, as they adapted, as they were able to lower the price, it increased the demand, more people were able to fly. And because of that, the ultra service, the ultra luxury, the people that wanted first class the way it used to be, the people that wanted first class seats started NetJets came out with NetJex, which is like a private jet. So now you can buy a fractional share of a private jet. So in real estate, is there a world in which you have high profile clients that want your advice over the long haul, that have trust or these lots of properties? Like, there's people out there that have lots of properties and they need help. And in fact, there's also people that there's going to be this transition in wealth. You know, talk to me about baby boomers. How are baby boomers, in your mind, affecting everything, but specifically real estate?
Well, I think this is well known. It was historically, for most of time, that when you became of retirement age, you downsized. When your kids moved out, you downsized. And to a degree that other generations of not baby boomers have not downsized. I think at least part of that is because baby boomers are the richest generation that has existed. So they don't need to downsize. It used to be that people had to downsize when they became of retirement age because they needed the money. They couldn't afford to stay in the 5-bedroom house that they raised their kids in. They needed to move to a cheap little bungalow because that's all they can afford. If baby boomers have a lot more money, then a lot of them will say, I don't need to move. Look, this is a 5-bedroom house that we raised our kids in, but even though we're empty nesters now, I don't need the money, so I'm going to stay in it. And that has led to that, like, slowed down the conveyor belt of real estate transactions to a degree that I think was unexpected and that we haven't seen in other generations. Now, the other side of that is that over the next 10 or 20 years, there will be a lot of forced real estate transactions when the baby boomers pass on. And so I think it's not necessarily that those transactions won't take place. They're just delayed to a different era. It's true for wealth as well. There's this interesting dichotomy of millennials being, on one end, over the last 10 years, one of the poorest generations at that age of their life. And at the other end, millennials will almost certainly be the wealthiest generation that has ever existed, in large part because of the money that they will inherit from their baby boomer parents. So all those transactions are simply delayed. And I think over the next 10 or 20 years, there'll be a ton of transactions that otherwise in a different generation would have taken place over the previous 10 years.
Now, what are your thoughts on how do people in the financial world view real estate? Because it is in my outside viewpoint looking in on financial advisors that when a financial advisor is working with a client, they're incentivized to sell them stock. It's like the man in the man with a hammer tendency. You know, they're holding the hammer and they're incentivized to get them mutual funds, stocks, REITs, right? So money under management. And so I think they probably rarely advise them to go talk to a realtor to sell or buy real estate or flip homes.
I think you're definitely right about that. But I think there's a reason that it occurs. There's a well-meaning reason that it occurs, which is the average person is not like you in their willingness to manage real estate. So the ability to manage a rental property is something that I don't think, less than 1 out of 10 people wants to, can do, or is qualified to do. You might have a different take on that, but I think that's why it occurs. The hands-off, relative, set-it-and-forget-it approach of owning a stock index fund, I think, is more appropriate for the vast majority of people to build wealth over time relative to the typical getting a call at 2 in the morning.
So a lot of the value in paying someone to help you invest is the convenience of it.
Yeah.
The hassle, yes. The hassle-free approach of it.
Yes. I mean, I guess one analogy might be like, there are very high-end health practices that you can do. If you want to be like top 0.1% of health, you can hire dietitians and personal trainers to get you to, but the average person doesn't want any of that. They're like, look, I know like there are these other things I could do, but I don't want any of it. I just want to go to the doctor and have my blood pressure checked once a year. And like, okay, I might exercise once or twice a month so I feel good about myself. But I think that's the equivalent. Like, yes, if you are someone who's like, I need to maximize every little bit of capital that I have, and I love investing in real estate, then great, it's awesome for you. But the vast majority of people just don't want that for their they want to give their money to a financial advisor and say, I want to hear from you as little as possible. Just invest my money as you see fit, and like, don't bother me most of the time. That's usually how it works.
Yeah. That's so interesting, because, you know, I was convenience and hassle, and the opposite of that is no hassle, is really important. And when it comes to selling a home, they oftentimes people will go with the agent that they feel will do the most, have the fullest service that requires the least lift and haul for them. Right. Yeah. So I may be able to give you great advice, right? Eat your broccoli and chicken breast and exercise 5 days a week and you'll lose weight. Or I could, you know, come up with another plan where I'm going to do a lot of the shopping for you. You know, I'm going to pick the food for you. I'm going to make it taste a little bit better, and you're going to have a couple cheat days, and, you know, and I'm going to find fun ways for you to work out where it's not going to the gym, but it's getting the same calorie burn, and I tricked you into having fun at it. But in real estate, oftentimes we go into these places and we give the best advice, but the best advice seems like a lot of work. Like, you should declutter. You need to declutter your house. You need to clean it professionally. You need to landscape your front yard. You need to replace the carpet and upgrade your kitchen. And then I'll get you top dollar. You're not getting the listing. It's like, oh my gosh, right? Versus, you know, talking about an advisor. Hey, I happen to have a contractor who can do the work. We can find ways to do this, X, Y, Z. So
totally. I mean, this is my own experience, and you and the other people listening are the pros, but this is my lay experience. In my life, I have used the services of three different realtors. Two did nothing. They did nothing. It was at the end, it was like, I can't even believe we hired you. Like, you didn't do anything for us. One of them went so far above and beyond, adding value, doing things that we had never thought of, taking everything off our plate, making us feel comfortable about the transaction. And the irony is, of course, all three of them earned the exact same commission, even though one of them was adding so much more value, infinitely more value than the other two. That, I think, is like where the industry is going. If I had to look at it, the first two that we used won't be in business in 5 years. The third one will be making more money than she made over the last 10 years. That's how it should be. And you're absolutely right that the idea of a realtor just coming to you and saying, this is what you need to do, versus a realtor coming to you and saying, I'm going to do this for you. The first one's going to be out of business. The second one's going to be making twice as much money as she was before.
It's true. So when it comes to investing too, back to this, it's like there's a return on hassle. So like, if I invest, I might make 10% return here, but there's a lot of hassle over here. I can make 8%, and I get to go on vacation and not worry about it. Now, one of the best things I ever done in my business too is created a property management company, which is a ton of hassle.
Yes.
Like most real estate companies, they don't do that because they're like, that sounds like a lot of hassle. Well, the point of creating something that is a lot of hassle is so that I can remove the hassle from my clients, and that allows them to work with me. You know how many people we've sold rentals to that would never considered it in the past, but knowing that I'm going to take it on for them, they're willing to do it. So you've proved the point. I've proven the point in the real world, but your theory, and it's not just theory, is reality.
It's just doing it for you. You're right. And I think it's true in something like medicine as well, where, I mean, this is a little bit more not how it should be, but most people, if they go to the doctor and the doctor says, you need to start exercising every day, and you can't drink alcohol anymore, you can't eat sweets anymore, I need you eating broccoli and kale and exercising every day, odds are that person's going to leave like feeling pretty poor about it, versus the doctor who's like, oh, I have a pill that you can take that will solve all your problems. That is way more alluring for people. So it's much more perverse in medicine, but it's true that most people, when they go to an expert for help, want convenience. They're like, I don't want to add any burden onto my life. And so this gets back to like, why do financial advisors by and large not say you should invest in rental properties? It's because that adds a level of burden that the client is trying to offload. They're like, I want fewer burdens, and you just gave me more. But you're totally right that like, if you add a property management level onto it, then you, as a, let's call them real estate advisors now. Let's not call them realtors anymore. That used to be stockbrokers, and they became financial advisors. Let's call them real estate advisors now. if you add that service, you're taking away burdens from people and you just like infinitely multiplied the value that you can offer to people.
And you don't have to own it. You don't have to own that company. You can just partner with or affiliate with or have a relationship with the best property management company in your world, right? Yeah. Be a win-win, right? It could be absolutely a win-win. You I asked you, one time we were talking, Morgan, and you're talking about electric cars or something like that, and it had to do with like the win-win of like the combination of two things. Where it was, do you remember this? Where it was like electric cars were boring and ugly, but then, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So the idea was on one end, you have the Toyota Prius, which is good for the environment, but it's so slow and it's so ugly. They went out of their way to make it as ugly as possible. And on the other end, you have the Ferrari, which is so high performance and so beautiful, but you might say it's worse for the environment. And the overlap of those two, the brilliant company that just took both of those elements was Tesla. And Tesla was like, hey, fully electric car, good for the environment if you love that. But if you like fast, beautiful sports cars, it is that too. It's that as well. Mm. No sacrifice. That's the genius of Tesla, was combining the Prius with the Ferrari and coming up with this thing that says nobody has to make any sacrifices. If you want to save the environment, you're doing that. You want a sports car, you get that too. And so just in any business, when you ask a consumer to make a sacrifice, you're immediately going to lose 80% of them, no matter what that sacrifice is. The other example of this is, and this is a little bit more controversial, but something like Beyond Meat, the fake meat companies. For years, veggie burgers tasted like absolute garbage. And so you had vegans and vegetarians who like, yes, I'm going to eat it. But it's a very small sliver of people who are willing to eat that garbage Boca burger. And then Beyond Meat comes in and be like, hey, if you don't want to eat meat, we respect that, but we're going to go as far as we possibly can to make it taste like a real burger. No sacrifice. And it's exploded. It's by far and away the most successful veggie burger company. And so that there's a long history of just being able to say like, look, as a business, I'm going to require that you make as few sacrifices as possible to give you this service.
To wrap this up, I need to talk to you and I need the audience to hear you talk about marketing and writing. And I don't know if you consider yourself a marketer, but I think you know a thing or two about marketing because you wrote a book that sold 5 million copies and is still on a runaway train. You have another book that has 250,000 copies and just launched 4 months ago and is likely to continue to sell for hopefully decades to come, right, Morgan? Because the way you write is fairly evergreen. So talk to business owners about writing and talk to them about how can writing be a way for them to market.
I think there's two things to keep in mind here that it's very important for writing and marketing. One is that nobody wants a lecture, but everybody loves a good story. And you would be surprised at, I think, what I would consider a lecture. The vast majority of marketing is a lecture in the sense that it's basically saying, hey, you dumb consumer, I bet you didn't know this, but let me teach you something. That's a lecture. Nobody wants that, but they love a story. Like everyone wakes up wanting to hear a good story. When you're sitting around the campfire with your bros, what are you doing? You're telling stories. People love it. And so if you can avoid lectures and tell stories, you win. And the good news for most people listening to this is I think the most interesting, entertaining, provocative stories exist in the financial world of people making bad decisions, of people making good decisions, of people making crazy decisions. They're everywhere in finance. Tell those stories, you get their attention. The other thing to keep in mind is it is very easy to underestimate how impatient people are. Make your point, make it quickly, and get the hell out of their way is what you got to do. The vast majority of most writing of what's wrong with it is it's too long. It's way too long. People don't have the attention span to read this. Now, being brief does not necessarily mean being short. You can write. There are 700-page books that are brief, I would say, because every word needs to be there. The problem is that people have this, they get in their own heads and they're like, I'm just going to stretch my legs and just throw as many words at the paper as I can. A lot of this comes from how we're taught to write in school. And the worst thing that writing teachers do in school is they give a minimum, a page minimum. So when you're in ninth grade, the teacher says, write a paper 5 pages minimum. that teaches kids, by definition, to be like, how can I throw as many words on the page as possible? What you need is to make your point in as few words as possible, in as few pages as possible. It's the opposite of what you're taught. So if you can tell a story with as little unnecessary words as needs to be there, you'll not only become a great writer, you become a great marketer. I do not consider myself a marketer because I just want to tell a story. Now, but I think if you do that, you will gain people's attention and get people to buy whatever product you're selling. And so it seems like a soft skill, particularly in like a tech-driven world. People want to learn to code. They don't want to learn how to write. But there's almost no business in which you are going to succeed unless you are an effective communicator. And writing online, where you have so much leverage, such a massive potential audience, is critical to no matter what you're doing.
We really are a proponent of writing, and that's on social media, that's on a blog, that's on your newsletter to your client, that's also internally as a leader. If you want to upgrade or level up your ability to lead it and inspire a company, you need to be able to write, not just get in front of them and speak. And for that, being clear and concise is important. Also, what we would call framing it in, you know, getting them to want to listen to you is a storytelling part. And how important is the familiarity of story versus a new story?
Well, I think what's important is you want to tell a story that people instantly understand the concept, but have never heard the details. If you're introducing a brand new concept, if you're explaining nuclear energy to an 8-year-old, they're going to be like, what are you even saying? Like, it's going to take me too much brain power to understand what you're saying. You want to explain something that is familiar with a new detail. And in finance, there are endless examples of stories of people making very bad financial decisions. Anyone can instantly empathize with that and understand what you're saying. This person spent more money than they earned. This person took too much risk than they could afford to take. This person used too much leverage. Whatever the story is, you instantly get it, but in a new detail. Now, there are plenty of times in finance where people will tell stories that everyone else has already heard before. Details about everyone's ever. Hey, have you heard about Bernie Madoff? Yes, of course I have. Everyone knows who he is. Don't tell me a story about him. And so that exists a lot. So you want to find something that people can instantly grasp, but they've never heard of at the same time.
Well, this has been awesome, Morgan. It's great to catch up with you. If you love what you heard about Morgan, he's been on many, many podcasts, including Tim Ferriss and many others. And you definitely, if you haven't read his book, Same As Ever, go grab a copy of that. We'll put that in the notes so you can grab that copy. Also, Psychology of Money is a must read and really a book that I've given out more than any other book in the last couple of years. It is a great gift. I've probably bought hundreds of them of the 5 million hundreds have come from me. So definitely go check that out. Morgan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nick. This has been fun.
Take care.